This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, Wither the Coal Town. Our reporter goes to Western Australia's only coal mining town and talks with local workers about how they see their future. And does the pricing model for the National Disability Insurance Scheme make key support services unviable? Agencies say they can't afford to pay staff when they're getting less than the award wage.
That's great for the workers that are actually already on one of the lowest wages in Australia. Oh, we're going to cut your wage a bit so that, you know, we can provide service. Great outcome.
One Nation has been exposed, seeking tens of millions of dollars in political donations from American gun lobby groups, including the powerful National Rifle Association, the NRA. Senior party figures James Ashby and Steve Dixon visited Washington late last year to solicit funding and were caught discussing strategies for watering down Australia's gun laws. Their trip was revealed in an Al Jazeera investigation that involved a fake gun rights group and hidden cameras. And it all took place just weeks before foreign donations were banned by the federal parliament with One Nation's support. Political reporter Melissa Clark.
One Nation's political fortunes have been rising and the party's backroom operators have big ambitions.
We would win, potentially balance of power, if we took two seats in the lower house. I reckon you could do that with $2 million. If you went 20, you would own the lower house and upper house.
That's James Ashby, Pauline Hanson's chief of staff.
Very simply, that means we have the testicles of the government in our hand at every given stage.
And that's Steve Dixon, One Nation's Queensland leader, a former state minister in an LNP government. In their search for money, the pair went to Washington to meet the NRA.
Mate, if they threw $10 million at us, we can win a heap of seats, plus five seats in the Senate, mate.
Their plotting was captured on covertly recorded footage that aired in an Al Jazeera documentary overnight.
For 3 years, Al Jazeera has been investigating the pro-gun lobby.
Al Jazeera Investigations set up a fake gun rights group.
Hey guys, Roger Muller here from Gun Rights Australia. We don't have our rights as gun.
And Roger Muller set up meetings between One Nation and the NRA and then filmed them with a hidden camera.
Nice to meet you too.
Not just the NRA, they also met with Koch Industries, owned by wealthy industrialists who support conservative campaigns. On their way to the meeting, Al Jazeera's fake gun advocate asks Steve Dixon and James Ashby about the millions they're hoping for.
But if we get to the point where we can talk about figures, what sort of number are you guys thinking?
I'm thinking 10. No, I was thinking 20.
20.
Sorry.
Mr. Ashby and Mr. Dixon met with a range of pro-gun lobby groups and advocates, but there's no evidence they were successful in getting the millions they were after.
Hey, we need about $10 million. Sorry.
Well, ain't going to be 10 million, I'll tell you that.
Well, I don't expect...
Personally, when I have to write the check, I'll give you $100. I'll give you $100 right now, no shit.
The NRA gave One Nation strategic advice.
Offense, offense, offense. And that is an effective communication strategy.
And ideas on what to say to gun control advocates when mass shootings occur.
How dare you stand on the graves of those children to put forth your political agenda?
Yeah.
You shame them to the whole idea.
I love that.
It's like you.
One Nation's American funding drive took place in September last year. 2 months later, Pauline Hanson was backing a bill in the Senate that led to foreign donations to political parties being banned.
Overseas money should not have an influence in our political scene as well, so I believe foreign donations should be stopped.
Senator Hanson wasn't on the trip. She was later recorded saying she didn't think it would have been a politically smart thing to do. Her chief of staff, James Ashby, was also concerned. His worries about the trip becoming public caught on Al Jazeera's cameras.
If it gets out, and rock the boat. This shit goes through my head every single minute of my day.
One Nation has refused to comment on the documentary. The party won't say whether it received any foreign donations before the law changed in November or if it will seek to wind back gun ownership laws.
Melissa Clark reporting, and those recordings were made by Al Jazeera. Its program, How to Sell a Massacre, a two-part investigation, airs tonight and Thursday at 8 p.m. on ABC TV and iView. And James Ashby has just released a statement. He claims Al Jazeera is a state-owned propaganda arm of the Qatari government that supports Islamic extremist groups. Mr. Ashby says One Nation's asked Al Jazeera to show complete transparency and release the full context of conversations, and that One Nation's referred the matter to ASIO and the Australian Federal Police due to concerns of foreign interference into Australian politics in the lead-up to the federal election. And the story is already causing outrage in Australia. Tim Fischer is a former National Party leader and was Deputy Prime Minister during the Port Arthur gun reforms. Thanks for talking to AM. What's your response to this story?
It's one of disgust and despair. We have to be reminded we need to be vigilant about the poisonous dollars and influence of the National Rifle Association of the USA every day, especially as it's now led by Oliver North, a globalist with dangerous influences around the world.
Does it worry you that One Nation was looking for foreign money to win seats, to win the balance of power and allegedly water down gun laws?
It does worry me a great deal as these allegations are firmed up. It's certainly something for One Nation to answer and for those directly involved, including Mr. Ashby, to answer, perhaps at some future Senate committee inquiry he might care to front and put his side of the story.
What should the federal government do?
Be alert. Be alert that the dollars and influence of the National Rifle Association of the USA is globally damaging. They have focused on Australasia before in 1996 and at various times since. They are led by Oliver North, a dangerous man, whichever way you look at him. But more so, remember that in the White House, as National Security Advisor, is a former Vice President of the National Rifle Association with world influence, his name John Bolton. Watch him closely as well.
We're very close now to a federal election being called. In your time as Deputy Prime Minister and leader of the Nationals, John Howard decided that One Nation should be preference last. Should that same approach be taken at this election?
Look, these are matters for those in up front in various political admin positions as they are. But you'd have to be influenced by the events of this last 24 hours. And influenced by other events to be very careful on the allocation of preferences and going anywhere near what is rapidly becoming a contaminated product that is One Nation on the ground in Australia.
And that's former National Party leader and former Deputy Prime Minister Tim Fischer. Disability service providers say the viability of the sector is at risk because NDIS red tape and of its policy positions. The sector's peak body says after 6 years of operation, the scheme's poor performance can no longer be blamed on growing pains. Lexi Metherill reports.
For 30 years, Canberra organisation LEAD has been helping people with disabilities get jobs. But recently it had to tell more than 100 of its clients it could no longer afford to provide them with one-on-one employment support. LEAD's business development manager is Jeff Thompson.
We'd been working with some people for 20 years or more, and unfortunately, just the way the pricing was, we couldn't afford to put a support worker alongside the person to do any kind of support because we were just losing money every hour.
He says the NDIS was paying less than the award wage for a full-time permanent support worker, and the only way to fund them would have been to cut their pay.
You know, it's quite frustrating because it seems to me like that gets said a lot, you know, you should have found some efficiencies. Well, yeah, that's great for the workers that are actually already on one of the lowest wages in Australia. Oh, we're going to cut your wage a bit so that, you know, we can provide service. Great outcome.
The sector says across the system, the NDIS is not funding the true cost of providing services. It says there's not enough funding for those with complex needs or those living in regional areas. The peak body, National Disability Services, has issued a list of demands to the federal government, including for a reduction in red tape and a new independent pricing body to be set up by July. Joan McKenna-Kerr is the body's president.
I wish it was growing pains, and this is certainly what, you know, we put it down to in the beginning, but 6 years is a lot of growing pains.
National Disability Services also wants the NDIS to put more emphasis on getting people with disabilities into work. That's a big frustration for Jeff Thompson.
We have about 30 jobs, 30 or 40 jobs at the moment, positions vacant for people with disabilities that we cannot fill because we can't get people with disabilities who have employment in their plan. We've got these contracts with the, you know, we're about to get a lawn mowing contract with the CFIRO. We're mowing the lawns at the new Canberra Hospital. We've got these jobs in Gungahlin that are just like the crews are ready and waiting to go. And we just can't find people.
Joan McKenna-Kerr says next week's budget is an opportunity to put the NDIS back on track.
It takes a lot for the disability sector to come out publicly. We're inclined to be a timid lot in some ways. But we think after 6 years, the situation has become so significant that unless something is done and done urgently, a number of services to people with disabilities will be jeopardised.
That's the President of the National Disability Services, Joan McKenna-Kerr, ending Lexi Metherill's report. And AM sought a response from the Office of the Federal Social Services Minister, Paul Fletcher. Australia is signing another free trade deal today, this time with Hong Kong. It's being formalised in Sydney. Trade between the two nations is currently worth about $14.5 billion a year. Both nations will need to ratify the deal through their parliaments, and given there's probably only three sitting days left of the current federal parliament, that's not likely to happen soon. The Trade Minister, Simon Birmingham, joined me earlier from our studios in Sydney.
Well, good morning, Sabra. This is the eighth trade deal signed by our government and with Hong Kong. It's signing a trade deal with our sixth largest export market. So it's a critical market. It's going to lock in zero tariffs for Australian exporters going into Hong Kong. It's got particular benefits for our services industries, and it really is just building upon that network now of eight different agreements that our government has done that is underpinning a record level of exports from Australia.
The Chamber of Commerce has published a trade survey today showing that a majority of businesses don't understand or use these agreements. If these deals are so good, why don't businesses rate them highly?
Well, actually, Sabra, we've seen growth of 16% in the number of Australian businesses who are exporting to the world during our time in government. So that's strong growth in the number of businesses. And what that's resulted in is
a
record
level.
Still,
you've got a large cohort there telling the Chamber of Commerce that they don't use them, a majority of their members.
And that's why, of course, you have to continue to make sure and that you go out and you advocate. But those benefits are being realised by businesses. 16% growth in the number of Australian businesses who are exporting whilst we've been in office. And importantly, that's translated into a trade surplus last year. That trade surplus is, of course, a big part of the reason for the record jobs growth that our government's been able to deliver and the more opportunities that creates for Australians.
Are there any provisions in this deal which could possibly harm Australia down the track, like an investor-state dispute settlement clause, put simply, a mechanism to allow foreign companies to sue Australia?
Well, Australia already has an investment treaty with Hong Kong. This replaces and updates that investment treaty, and it does so by putting in place more protections.
Do we have a clause, an investor-state dispute settlement clause?
Absolutely, Sabra, and we have one with more protections for Australia's rights in terms of legislating in relation to public health, the environment and otherwise. So this is
Why have something like that, given that tobacco giant Philip Morris in recent years used one of these provisions to take legal action against plain packaging of cigarettes here, and that cost Australia $38 million to defend?
Well, it didn't actually cost Australia that much in the end because we did get some of that funding back.
Freedom of information revealed that cost.
But Sabra, importantly, these provisions have never been used successfully against Australia. Australian companies, however, in their investments, in their expansions overseas, have been able to use these provisions to protect themselves. And if we did not have this new agreement with Hong Kong, then the old treaty arrangements that Philip Morris used would stay in place.
Minister, how should the Prime Minister deal with One Nation, given the Al Jazeera revelations today that the organisation was hoping to gain millions from the gun lobby in the United States to help them win seats and the balance of power in Parliament?
Pauline Hanson should clearly front the cameras today. She should explain whether or not she was truly seeking an amazing $20 million in foreign donations to One Nation, to her political party, whether or not she was again expecting to personally profit from an election campaign, whether or not she actually believes we should be weakening Australia's gun laws, which is a remarkable thing to even contemplate at this time of reflection upon the tragedy in Christchurch. There are many answers here for One Nation who are a risk to our trade policy, who are a risk to our national harmony and integrity, and indeed who appear to be a risk to our foreign donation law bans, to our gun laws as well.
You're on preferencing One Nation. You've previously said that extremists should be put last. How do you think this group should be preferenced?
Well, I want to see everybody who nominates, but I am very clear in my views that Australians ought to reject extremism in all of its forms. They ought to reject the extremism of One Nation, the extremism of Fraser Anning in terms of the way in which they undermine the ability of us to build a stronger, more cohesive society. They ought to reject the extremism of their anti-trade policies. They ought to reject the extremism of the Greens' anti-trade policies as well, for that matter, or the Greens' high-taxing policies. There's a range of different things to contemplate when it comes to finally preferences, but extremism ought to be rejected by Australians in all of its forms.
Minister, thanks for joining AM this morning.
Thank you, Sabra.
That's the Trade Minister, Simon Birmingham. Australian businesses exporting to China say they're still fairly optimistic about the world's second largest economy, despite a slowdown and delays for coal exporters. An annual survey out today from Westpac and the Australian Business Chamber in Shanghai finds optimism about China is down, yet profits are picking up. And while relations with Beijing have been rocky, Australian businesses have largely been unaffected. Here's China correspondent Bill Birtles.
More than 200 businesses were surveyed in the only annual snapshot of sentiment for companies dealing with China. And while almost 3 out of 4 are optimistic about the year ahead, the percentage of companies bullish about China's market is down, while those saying they're slightly pessimistic is up 10%. Jack Brady from Auschamp Shanghai says broader diplomatic issues may be setting the mood.
I think what is in the minds of many businesses is what they read in the media. And there's no doubt about the marketplace for consuming news at the moment is risky. There's an interest in geopolitical concerns between the US and China, and Australian businesses factor that into their decision making.
In recent weeks, the headlines have been closer to home, with delays for Australian coal shipments at multiple Chinese ports. Officially, it's due to more inspections, but Australian diplomats acknowledge the lack of clarity from the Chinese side has left some wondering if China is also trying to send a message. Australia's relationship with its biggest trading partner has run hot and cold in recent years, but Jack Brady says businesses are still doing well regardless.
What's particularly pleasing is that year on year, there was a 20 percentage point increase from Australian businesses that are reporting that their China business is profitable.
While resources companies are expected to feel China's slowdown the most, those businesses selling to the growing middle class are still riding high. Emily Dunn handles government relations in Beijing for supplements maker Swiss.
Well, even in times of economic slowdown, I think people are always focused on their health. So we see health products, particularly our products, to have really strong growth prospects. And China's always going to be busy, even if it's slowing down. It's not slowing down by much.
For all the positive talk, more than half the respondents say China's regulatory environment isn't transparent. And while some Australian startups have found success in America's Silicon Valley, there are almost no young entrepreneurs doing the same in China's vibrant tech scene. Sean Hyatt is an independent business consultant in Beijing.
One would be pretty accurate in saying that there's not much opportunity in China from a competitive aspect for running a startup in China. Because you see when like people like Uber come into China, Didi just copies it and then they win the market. Especially around the tech sort of industry, there's a lot of worries about the sort of stuff that Trump talks about the idea of stealing of IP and technology that I think drives Australian business away to look at maybe more like an American market or the UK or Europe in the way maybe an Atlassian has done.
With such a small presence in China's tech and manufacturing scene, Australia is largely immune from the core issues of Donald Trump's trade dispute with Beijing, which means whatever happens, Australian companies are generally confident they'll be able to carry on and keep doing business. This is Bill Birtles in Beijing, reporting for AM.
You'd be forgiven for thinking the debate over coal versus renewable energy sometimes feels like a political plaything. What about the people who work in the coal industry? What do they think? Our reporter, Eliza Borello, has been to the West Australian's only coal mining town, Collie, and put simply, workers there are nervous.
Collie's coal mines lie 200 kilometres southeast of Perth, surrounded by forest and farmland. They've employed four generations of Paul Moisey's family.
Yeah, my granddad worked in the coal mines. My father, I did, and my son did an apprenticeship in the coal mines. So, yeah, it means quite a lot to me.
Paul Moisey's isn't against renewable energy. In fact, he sheepishly concedes he has solar panels on his roof. But he's desperate for Collie, the town he loves, to survive and believes hanging on to coal for as long as possible is key to that.
You know, we are so fortunate to be able to live in a country town surrounded by bush, fresh water, lakes, and be able to work in the mining industry just, you know, 15 minutes out of town. We come back and sleep in our own beds.
Paul Moisey's works for Premier Coal. It sends its product to the Muja Power Station, which provides electricity for southwest WA. The government-owned power station is contracted to buy coal from Premier until 2030. But with the number of WA homes with solar panels at 30% and rising, renewables expert Ray Wills is forecasting a short future for coal-fired power in WA unless government intervenes.
By 2025, I think there'll be not only more pressure from solar but also more pressure from wind, and old coal-fired power stations simply won't cope in that arrangement. Coal could well be exiting by 2025 in Western Australia.
Predictions like this worry Paul Moisey's.
But hopefully we get friends in the government that see a future in Collie and the coal industry.
WA's Energy Minister Bill Johnston sees a future for Collie.
We've had an incredible level of investment in Collie, so I can't see why Collie would, in my view, would be Collie would remain the centre of the energy sector for a long period of time.
But he doesn't see as long a future for the town's state-owned power stations.
The Muja plants have been in place for quite a long time, and you wouldn't expect them to go for forever. We're looking at what's a sensible closure.
Like Ray Wills, he says technology is what's driving the change.
Now we've got these intermittent renewable supply that come on when they are available. The sun doesn't shine at night. The wind doesn't always blow, so you have to balance that against the existing plant, and that is a very, very complicated process, and there's no question that's making life harder for the coal-fired power stations to stay in the system.
The local shire estimates a quarter of the 5,000 people employed in Collie work in the coal industry, and the shire president, Sarah Stanley, wants more than the 2 years' notice. She believes the government energy generator Synergy is required to give the shire if it's going to pull the plug on coal-fired power.
That's not nearly enough time for people who are relying on the work at either the coal mines or the power stations to put food on their family's table.
Synergy refused multiple interview requests but insists it has no plans to retire all of the Muja power station by 2025. Premier Cole argues talk of coal's rapid demise is inappropriately exaggerated, while Griffin Coal, Collie's other coal company, says it has contracted sales with industry for the next 30 years.
Eliza Borello reporting. The US president has suggested Israel and the United States may take offensive action to secure Israel from threats to its security. Donald Trump signed a presidential proclamation recognising Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights. At the same time, the Israel Air Force attacked targets in Gaza. Israel's prime minister says the country will respond forcefully to a rocket strike that's destroyed a house and wounded seven people. Middle East correspondent Eric Torchek reports.
It's my honour to welcome Prime Minister Netanyahu to the White House. A very special man. He's done a great job.
As Israel's election campaign entered its final fortnight, incumbent Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu enjoyed a pre-poll present from Donald Trump.
In a moment, I will sign a presidential proclamation recognizing Israel's sovereign right over the Golan Heights.
The Heights are recognized internationally as being a part of Syria, occupied by Israel since the war of 1967. But Donald Trump says Israel must retain the area for its own security.
Today, aggressive action by Iran and terrorist groups in southern Syria, including Hezbollah, continue to make the Golan Heights a potential launching ground for attacks against Israel.
At the same time the leaders were meeting in Washington, Israeli jets were attacking the Gaza Strip in response to a rocket attack which destroyed a house northeast of Tel Aviv and wounded seven Israelis. Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel is retaliating.
Israel will not tolerate this. I will not tolerate this. And as we speak, Israel is responding forcefully to this wanton aggression.
The Israeli military says its air force destroyed the security and intelligence headquarters of the Islamist group Hamas, which controls Gaza. Israeli aircraft also bombed other targets. Benjamin Netanyahu is cutting short his trip to the United States and returning home for a meeting of Israel's security cabinet, which will discuss further military options against Hamas and other factions in Gaza.
I have a simple message to Israel's enemies. We will do whatever we must do to defend our people and defend our state.
The rocket strike followed a launch from Gaza on March the 14th, which Hamas said was an accident. It's also just 2 weeks before Israel holds national elections. Many Israeli politicians on the campaign trail called for tougher action against Hamas, including Education Minister Naftali Bennett.
Unfortunately, every piece of territory that we hand over to Arabs turns into a base of Iran and of radical Islamic terror. The only way is to respond and to respond strong.
The United Nations says it's working with Egypt to negotiate with all sides to de-escalate the situation. But Israel sent more troops and equipment to the border, and militant groups in Gaza promised resistance to and retribution for any Israeli attack. From Jerusalem, this is Eric Twarczyk reporting for AM.
With no deal in sight and Brexit now officially delayed until April or May, the UK Parliament is stuck in a hamster wheel of debate and disorder. The latest tawdry twist, a failed weekend attempt to dislodge Theresa May from the leadership. The hardcore Brexiteers who've led the Parliament into chaos are now offering to support Mrs May's toxic Brexit deal as long as she steps down. Europe correspondent Linton Besser reports.
It's spring in Westminster, where the world's most famous parliament has succumbed to monoplegia. Only one topic is really ever debated, to no end whatever.
Mr Speaker, I continue to believe that the right path forward is for the United Kingdom to leave the EU as soon as possible with a deal, now on the 22nd of May. But it is with great regret that I have had to conclude that as things stand, there is still not sufficient support in the House to bring back the deal for a third meaningful vote.
The arch-Brexiteers within Theresa May's government have blocked every attempt she's made to get her EU withdrawal deal through the Parliament. And now, without a hint of irony or even shame, they're saying the deal isn't the problem. The problem, in fact, is her.
Theresa May has, to some extent, lost the trust of Parliament, having told us so many times that no deal is better than a bad deal or that we are definitely leaving on the 29th of March. None of those things have turned out to be a real view, and I think there is a lack of confidence now.
John Whittingdale is a member of the so-called European Research Group, a hard faction of Brexit-at-all-costs MPs who have taken the Tory party, the Parliament and the country to the brink of a constitutional crisis. Overnight, he was one of a number of the faction wheeled out to apply new pressure on Theresa May. Apparently, her twice-defeated Brexit deal would be more attractive if she wasn't its champion.
I think it would make it more likely that the agreement would get support.
He even fired a shot at Mrs. May's lack of commitment
If we had a leader who was committed to extracting the maximum benefits of this country, which we would have from an open free trading arrangement with the EU, then that would give us more confidence.
Undeterred, Theresa May has doggedly stuck to the top job and her deal.
But the bottom line remains, if the House does not approve the withdrawal agreement this week and is not prepared to countenance leaving without a deal, we will have to seek a longer extension.
Members of the House of Commons will continue shouting at each other this week over indicative, non-binding votes that some might think were completely irrelevant, while the European Union continues to wait for something or someone resembling a proper negotiating partner. It's like watching passengers on the Titanic voting to move the iceberg. This is Linton Besser in London for AM.
That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.